ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
The Australian wilderness attracts visitors from far and wide. And if you saw ABC TV's Australian story this week about the Belgian backpacker Céline Kremer, you'll have been reminded that it can also be a very treacherous place. Well, it's against this backdrop that the murder mystery dark comedy series Deadlock explores tensions around Australian identity, around different concepts of ownership and gender. Its first season was set in Tasmania, and its second season uses the tropical top end as its canvas and sees the return of the odd couple investigating duo Dulcie Collins and Eddie Redcliffe, once again thrown into a conspiracy of murder and greed.
What are you doing here?
We're trying to solve a high-profile murder.
He's dead to me.
Yeah, he's dead to everybody because he's dead. This is a classic territorial dispute between Lana Crocs.
G'day, g'day.
And the Darrells.
My family run this town.
Hello, I'm Jason DeRosso. This is The Screen Show, brought to you by ABC Radio National. And my first guests today are the co-creators and co-writers of Deadlock. But also coming up in this episode, you're going to hear from French director François Ozon on his excellent adaptation of Albert Camus' The Outsider. And you'll hear from Russian-American director Julia Lochtev, who has made a documentary about Putin's crackdown on journalism from the inside. But first to Deadlock Season 2, a show that mixes the understated humour of a contemporary workplace drama with an Australian larrikin streak. It features a pair of investigators, a rough round the edges Eddie, played by Madeleine Sami, and a more repressed and often infuriated Dulcie, played by Kate Box. They both find themselves investigating an entanglement of corruption and murder in the top end. Eddie is from here originally, and this homecoming is a fraught one. Dulcie is from Tasmania. You'll know this if you were a fan of the first series of Deadlock. And her introduction to the tropics is unsettling, to say the least. Oh, and she sweats copiously. It's a show that is frequently funny, and I think it's very cleverly written. Although there's something in its strain of broad humour that reminds me of the beloved series Kath and Kim or Kingswood Country, or even the Barry McKenzie films before that. It's this tendency to bang the same nail on the head again and again, and that repetition never quite knows when it outstays its welcome, although, of course, it has its fans. What I like about this show is that it's saying something, I think, quite relevant to contemporary Australia. It reserves a special place in hell for the unscrupulous types who choose to exploit the beauty and drama of our landscapes to build tourism and media empires. The co-writers and co-creators of Deadlock, Kate McCartney and Kate McLennan, who, yes, also starred in their own very funny cooking show parody, The Catering Show, are coming up. A warning, there's some strong language ahead.
If an extra pair of hands is needed to figure out the victim's last movements, I can
Hang on, did you say Tasmania?
Yes.
What's your name again?
Dulcie Collins.
You're that dead lake bird. You know you're the talk of the group chat. Hey, you fucked up an investigation so royally, you got three innocent men killed.
One of them was a serial killer, actually.
Yeah, well, look, thanks for the offer, but I don't need any help. You know, particularly from Nancy Drew's fucking stretched out addict twin. Have a good one.
Okay, boys, we've got to do this presser. What do you reckon, aviators on or off?
On.
Yeah, I reckon on.
Kate McCartney and Kate McLennan, welcome to The Screen Show.
Thank you.
So this season is set in Darwin or thereabouts in the top end. What's it like to go from one season set in Tasmania to the second season set in at the other end of the country, basically? I mean, is it a big logistical enterprise to kind of shift the production up there? Is it a big pitching exercise to pitch that as the new location for a second series?
Yes. Yeah.
I mean, you kind of, you know, when you're writing something and you get to make a show, and then really it should be easier when you do the second series because, you know, you have the sets and you have the crew and, you know, you have these things in place.
You've got the seal puppet,
yeah,
you know,
you've got the seal puppet
that you can reuse.
But we decided, no, we're going to take all of those advantages and we're just going to completely throw them out the window and start afresh. So it is, yeah, it was a huge challenge, I think, because we, you know, we had to still find, I guess, travel the deadlock DNA of the show to a new location and let that new location inform so much of the story and the palette and the feel of the show, but still maintain those kind of quintessential elements of what a deadlock story is. So it was a real challenge, but, you know, and a logistical challenge as well going up to the territory because we were sort of hard up against the end of the dry season as well when we were shooting. So we could only shoot a shorter portion of the show in the territory before we had to go before the rains came. And also we had to shoot all of the water work in crocodile free waters. So
how difficult is that to find, to locate?
Well, you can't do it in the territory, essentially.
I mean, our insurance wouldn't cover it. So they were perfectly fine with us taking it over to Queensland where there are just bull sharks.
Yeah, it's southeast Queensland. Okay. To clarify, not north Queensland.
Just bull sharks. Well, that's fine.
It's okay.
Apparently it's okay for Kate Box to have her leg taken off by a bull shark.
Yeah, it's fine. Like insurance covers sharks, but not crocodiles.
The first show was set against, or the first season was set against the gentrification of Tasmania. And this is a show in which you've got this character played by Luke Hemsworth, Jason Wade, who's this superstar kind of croc wrestler. And it's really a show that's really concerned with tourism and Australian tourism in the top end and the way Australia projects its image to the world, but also itself as this kind of crocodile safari park spectacle where First Nations people also are pretty happy stakeholders. And this is a show that smashes that surface really and gets beneath that. What were you wanting to explore and draw out from the satire?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's that, like all those themes and stuff and all those sort of ideas is definitely stuff we were hoping to explore. We were interested in the way Australia's conception of itself is really grounded in that conqueror, explorer, colonial kind of mindset of like you can't have a relationship with the land unless you're
dominating it.
And the language around extracting something and how masculinized that is and how connected to patriarchy that is. And then kind of women's complicity within that, white women's particularly complicitness within that. Yeah, it's been a really interesting thing to kind of wrangle and to kind of see if we could actually put on the screen. I'm glad you kind of figured you sorted that. That's good, isn't it?
I must be paid for something here.
Our costume designer, when she was looking at all of the, you know, the costumes for Jason and all of the characters that work at Land of Crocs, and we sort of really had these conversations about the performance of masculinity and how, they are sort of like these costumes that are being put on and, you know, they are quite larger than life. And so, you know, then that kind of led us to really looking at gender as well and how people represent themselves and identify up there as well.
And so the costumes people wear in order to fit in. Mm. And then also, like, who does the sort of international and the self-conception of, like, who Australia is, who does that leave out?
Mm. Yeah, so you've got a lot of men in very tight, small shorts but nicely ironed, and there's a lot of polyester, a lot of...
it's breathable.
It's breathable.
I think it's
fine. And it wicks liquid. Is that the expression?
It's moisture wicking.
Moisture wicking. So there's a lot of that. Tell me about, there's a moment very early on in the series where someone says that there's no community here. And I just feel like in the way that you present detective work in these shows, it is about an exercise of care and caring, really. And that in some ways your shows are about demonstrating that there is community, even though apparently there isn't, you know, or maybe it's very dysfunctional, but somehow there is community. And I'm wondering if you could talk about the way that you conceive of these worlds and, you know, if you do view them with a kind of love and a kind of empathy, even warts and all, I guess.
Yeah. I mean, season one was, to us, it was that there had been a community that had been built, but sort of on the, I guess, the grounds of something that wasn't stable. So I think, you know, it was a disintegration of a community. Whereas season two, I think we really wanted to look at this place and go, well, there's been fundamental things that have been ripped out of this place that have meant that it's worked against the formation of a community. And there's been wedges driven in town and, you know, resources have been pulled. Like we talk about the pool being filled in and we talk about the police station that used to be a school, and just this idea that the town used to be something, but it has kind of had roadblocks put in its way.
It's a conversation around who do we trust to create community?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Who should be creating community?
And we want it to be very deliberate that we've got a police station that is the centre of the town. Like that was a very intentional, and that the rest of the town is built around this building. And so for us, it was kind of like looking at different people, different characters in the story who are trying to build community, who are protecting each other and caring for each other, and how that works in comparison to, you know, government, police, you know, bureaucracy, I suppose. It's like community care, and looking at how that can evolve, you know, over the series as well. Because I guess for us, it's like, I mean, everything that we write is kind of about community, because it's probably the most important thing that you can have as a society, I think. So it's, yeah, and so it was really important to us to kind of look at that again as a theme for season two, because it's sort of like one of our, you know, overarching themes, because, you know, the show is it's about Australia, just in different locations, and how we kind of do have a fractured sense of community. And that's probably one of the issues with us as a country. And so, you know, it's our dream, it's our hope that we can build a stronger community. So it's like, it is sort of aspirational in a way. It is fantastical.
Yeah, it is kind of, yeah.
How much was the Matt Wright case? And I want to be careful about what I say about that case, and I kind of really don't want to say anything about it, but, you know, people will know of it. The Matt Wright case, you know, was in the headlines in, you know, over the last sort of couple of years, really, a bit more than that, perhaps. How much was that playing in your minds as an influence or as an inspiration when you were writing this?
It kind of wasn't, because we had written this, like, well before any of that. So yeah, it's kind of that character, like Matt Wright is like one of just many iterations of a new version of the Larrikin. So it's like, it's not so, it's just like, this is what this season's model of the Australian Larrikin is. It's still ostensibly a white male who is still conquers, who still sort of, you know.
Well, I guess we've had the Leyland brothers going right back, and probably others, but, you know, and Steve Irwin perhaps is
Steve Irwin is I will never say a bad word about Steve Irwin.
Right. I was going to say he's kind of in that umbrella, but
I love him. I love Robert Irwin.
Right.
And I would love to work for them. So, like, I would never. I love him.
But even
so
that's just looking at, like, you know, Crocodile Dundee, he was like an inspiration. Like the first, you know, 15-20 minutes of Crocodile Dundee before, you know, it all shifts off country. You know, that was a huge inspiration to the show. It was like, you know, we had a scene in there that was, we had a buffalo in right up until the last moment where we couldn't get a buffalo on set. But it's
buffalo,
like, we really
in the wrong town, we couldn't get it.
Yeah. So it was about kind of acknowledging that tradition of those types of, and like you like said, how those projections.
Kind of, yeah, they change a little from year to year, but like, what's the utility of them? You know, like who do they serve?
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting, even like just looking at, you know, things evolving since then, you know, like since we made the show, and you know, it's like Matt Wright has then been replaced with that AI. Like, have you seen, there was like an AI Indigenous account that was a completely fake, that was like this like wildlife kind of warrior type guy, and it was all just a complete AI fabrication. Like, it just, you know, it's, I don't know what's going to be next, you know.
Yeah. Tell me about the whole gender aspect to this show, because it's so important. It's been important behind the camera because, you know, so many of your creatives, or you can correct me on, you know, the majority of your key creatives are female and or women.
Yeah, we have, I mean, we have a lot of like women working on the show, and non-binary people, and we just, yeah, that's like important to us, like from the creative side of things, from just having a different lens on the situation. Both of our directors are female as well. So it's just, you know, I think it's really interesting to kind of, like we don't know how like a male director or male writer or, you know, how this story would be without having kind of their eyes on stuff.
Both our editors are women.
Yeah. So it's, we really, yeah, we feel very grateful that they've sort of come along for the ride with us. But it's like, it's super important as well, like, you know, actually on camera as well, that we do have, you know, it's sort of, we don't just have just like straight up, straight white person and straight, like, let's, you know, which kind of like to have lots of different shades and of people's identities, I suppose.
I mean, it's quite a, we should say there's quite a queer element to it, of course, as well. So it's queer and very female led. Funny I should pick up on that. I don't know if you know that, but I'm just telling you what you've made here. But also, no, it's interesting because, and you've spoken about this a lot, I'm sure, because, you know, in the first season you would have spoken about it, but it does, it is also a show that subverts that whole thing of that really common cliche in a lot of policiers procedurals now, which is about the dead girl, you know, or the dead girls and the serial killer on the loose. And both seasons aren't about that. It's about women investigating essentially dead bits of men.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah. Like we wanted to, like it's sort of about
giving, and the death of the crocodile.
Yeah. Giving a voice.
That's true. And the death of the crocodile, which is actually quite important. We're not being flippant there. It's actually quite important for the sort of the symbolism of what the crocodile represents to various characters.
That's right.
Yeah, definitely. It was super important for us to have, you know, sort of this idea that, you know, people were being reflected on screen that weren't usually given a voice or screen time in these stories. So, you know, for us, that's what it's about. And, you know, you just kind of, like I said yesterday, it's like, you know, why have two lesbians when you can have 16, you know? It's like...
That's what I've always said.
And also, you know, like we like to show people from minorities also being awful and flawed and, you know, telling jokes. So it's like everyone gets
to be funny on their show.
Yeah.
Yeah. Where do you guys live? Because you live quite close to each other physically.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And so you're still in Melbourne?
Yeah. 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 We're in Melbourne.
And did you spend much time in the in the Northern Territory, and do you miss it at all? Because it's a very different climate. And I think that's what also someone asked me the other day if I had an example of TV shows or films that depict heat well. I couldn't think off the top of my head. And this show does do that quite well.
Yeah, it's a funny, I think like Southeast Asian cinema does it quite well.
Someone said in that conversation, Simon Yang. Yeah, you're totally right. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And like, you know, and then you kind of, and we looked a lot at sort of gothic horror as Southern gothic stuff as well, that kind of Bayou kind of, and then also South American films as well, like that kind of like the tropical stuff kind of, yeah, it was, but it is like, yeah, it's, I can't remember what your question was.
It was one of those.
We're in Melbourne. We did spend time. We went and we took ourselves up on a research trip up there, and it was like delightful because it was just us. It was kind of like we're on our honeymoon and we just had the best. I had the best time. It was so fun. And I mean, like, I don't know. There's something very freeing. I really like it. Like, I love humidity. So I was like,
if you just
lean into your curl pattern when you're up there and you go, this is what I'm going to be wearing. This is what I'm going to be. And it's great.
There's probably something to be said also, and we did this with season one as well, which producers don't like. Nobody likes this, but I think it actually does work well for the final product. It's, you know, we do write a lot as we're shooting as well, and so you can react to where you are in real time. And so we will, you know, we're rewriting, like, handing pages to actors the morning that they're shooting.
I mean, I would say I don't like it either, but like I see the value in it. But yeah, I also, God, I'd love not to be on a computer while the show is being shot in front of me.
But it is pretty fun to, you know, there's something that'll happen, you know, the day before on the way to work, and then you can write it into a script, and there's something that is so iconic and it needs to be in the show because you're like, this would only ever happen where we are, and we haven't finished shooting that day yet on that location, so let's just try and get that joke in or try and get that prop or that joke just to squeeze that in while we still can because, you know, we haven't wrapped yet. So
yeah, I mean, like, I don't think Zupa Dupa's really factored necessarily in the scripts until we got up there when we all became broadly obsessed with Zoopadoopers.
That's right.
Yeah, I feel the show has that, you know, shows that ability to, behind the camera, you've just absorbed these little details. I feel like that's there. Even in, there's an early scene with Sprinklers come on in the moment of emotional kind of coming apart or, you know, and I thought, gee, I wonder if that was written into, it was a lovely moment. It was very Australian, someone sitting on a lawn and then suddenly the Sprinklers come on.
And it's like up there, like you, wherever there's grass, there's got to be something watering it. Otherwise, like, it's just such wouldn't
a funny,
survive.
It's such a funny conceit to have a European city in that, like the architecture, in order for it to kind of exist within that space, it's all like militarized. Like there's a lot of things that they took from the military context and put it in that. So if you want a European city in there, this is what you have to do. You have to stay indoors. You have to basically have air conditioning going all the time. You have to like there's no coincidence that like the population of Florida increased when air conditioning got invented, you know, like, and same with Northern Territory. It's like, if you want this kind of place to exist, then you have to make it, fake it, basically. Yeah. You have to create it.
Kate McCartney and Kate McLennan, co-creators and co-writers of Deadlock Series 2, screening now on Prime Video. You're listening to The Screen Show with me, Jason DeRosso, brought to you by ABC Radio National.
Aujourd'hui, je suis retournée au bain. J'ai fermé les yeux et j'ai senti ta tête posée sur mon ventre. Quand j'ai rouvert les yeux, tu n'étais pas là. Pourquoi avoir brisé ce bonheur qui nous attendait? Pourquoi as-tu tué cet homme?
Monsieur Norso?
Oui.
French filmmaker François Ozon is one of the most prolific directors in contemporary cinema. His new film screened in competition at Venice last year, an adaptation of Albert Camus' The Outsider called The Stranger. It's a story of love and murder set during the 40s in Algeria, and it's sculpted on the big screen into a sensual and haunting work of high contrast black and white. It's a film of heat and languid movements, but also of sudden passions and simmering resentments. A young office worker named Meursault, played by a superb Benjamin Voisin, travels to the countryside to bury his mother and seems to slowly disintegrate like aspirin in a glass of water, turning into an aimless, amoral wanderer. He falls into the dangerous orbit of a neighbour, a local thug and fellow French colonial who beats his Arab wife, and he embarks casually on an affair with an attractive work colleague, Marie. Camus' book was much appreciated as an exploration of alienation and entropy, but Camus was also a controversial figure. The great post-colonial thinker Edward Said wrote a lot about Camus, quite even-handedly, I think. But he didn't shy away from a very strong critique of The Outsider's depiction of its Arab characters. He wrote, "They are nameless beings used as background for portentous European metaphysics." I think what Ozon's film does expertly is blend the personal with the political via a considered cinematic depiction of impassivity, its cruelty, via a considered cinematic depiction of its central character. Using the statuesque presence of Voisin, he creates a character that embodies an emotional numbness that serves, I think, as a reminder of colonialism's chauvinism and indifference and its inevitable tendency to racist violence. I caught up with François Ozon before Easter, and I began by asking about the challenge of bringing Camus' story into the 21st century.
For me, it was important not to make a film of 1942. 1942 is the release of the book in France and in all the world. It was important to make a film with the eyes of today. So I wanted to focus on the contextualization of the story. At the same time, I wanted to have a modern vision on this book, because the book, when you read it today, you realize there is a kind of invisibilization of the Arab, which is can be problematic for many people. And when I read the book again, because I read it, of course, when I was a student, like all the young people in France, I realized how this book was still powerful and mysterious. But at the same time, we needed to contextualize the story, to explain to the audience of today what was Algeria at this time. Actually, it was France. It was French departments. And so I needed to contextualize, to understand better what Camus wanted to say with this book.
And so is this partly why we have the two female characters in the book? We don't explore, you know, we don't know that much about them, but they seem to be more foregrounded in your film. Was this part of your attempt to modernize the story?
I don't know if it's modernizing, but for me, I felt a kind of lack reading the book because this woman didn't really exist. And for me, it was important, especially because I realized all the men in the book are all toxic, you know. One is beats his wife, the other one beats his dog, and the other one kills an Arab because of the sun. So it's difficult to identify to this character. So I had the feeling it was important to develop the female character, to give them a conscience of what happens, especially the tension between the two communities. So I developed the character of Marie, who is actually a modern woman, you know, in her behavior, and she realized what's happening. And the sister of the victim, who is important because it's a way to give a voice to the Arab community.
This story has a particular personal relevance to you, or resonance, doesn't it? Because your family, I think on your father's side, was in Algeria. So I think your grandfather was a judge.
My grandfather. It was my mother. Actually, all the French have a link with Algeria, French Algeria. And it's still a wound for many French and many Algerians too, you know. And there is still a lot of political tensions between the two countries. So that's why it was impossible for me to shoot in Algeria. I had to shoot in Morocco. But yes, I realized making this film, I had a family background in Algeria too. My grandfather was a judge in a small city, and during the war between the two countries, he escaped to an attack. I don't know if you say that in English.
I think I read somewhere that he escaped a terrorist attack. Is that right? A bombing?
A terrorist attack. Yes, exactly. Exactly. So all the family had to come back to France. And I realized something we didn't speak about in the family, but it was a real thing and a wound for my grandfather and my grandmother because they loved to live there.
I really enjoyed, especially in the first half of the film, the beginning of the film, the way that the film uses the passing of time and pays attention to the details of his journey. Mm-hmm. And the process around the dead body and the period of the official period of mourning, the funeral and so forth. Of course, this protagonist remains quite untouched by emotion in all of this, which is a very strange thing, obviously. And you capture that strangeness beautifully. But I feel the film begins with this hypnotic atmosphere. Can you tell me about that and your attempt to capture the atmospheric essence of this book cinematically?
Yes. I had the feeling of when I read the book, I realized I could make a kind of silent movie with all the first part. I didn't need explanation. I didn't need dialogues. I had to show everything with the camera and with the frame, with the mood, and it was a way to be close to the character. Of course, the book is a kind of monologue, so one of the possibility of adaptation would have been to have a voiceover during all the film. But for me, it was more interesting to ask to the audience to observe the character and to try to understand him like a scientist with an insect, you know. And so I had this idea to be very close to him and to to observe him and to try to understand why, what is inside. He's like a white page on which you can project some emotions, some ideas, all what you want.
Benjamin Voisin is a fantastic face for this role.
Yes,
he is so interesting to look at. And he's a beautiful looking man, but there is something a little bit perverse in the face. Somehow, there's something, right?
I will tell him.
That's really great for an actor to have. I mean, it makes me think, I don't know why Visconti cast Mastroianni in this role, which seems to me to be...
Big mistake.
Big mistake.
I love Mastroianni. He's an amazing actor.
And Visconti, of course, is great, but yeah.
He's so Italian. And actually, when I discovered the film of Visconti, I didn't know the film because the film is not well known in France. He didn't work when it was released. And I read an interview of Visconti explaining his first choice for the casting was not Mastroianni, but Alain Delon. And suddenly, it would have been fantastic. So Benjamin Voisin is a kind of my Alain Delon today.
I like the way that obviously death hangs over the film. And it's death in this very sunny place. I really like the way that the whites seem quite bleached. Can you tell me a little bit about the look of the film and the cinematography and maybe even the grading, how you approached the element of sunshine and shadow? Mm-hmm.
Speaking with the DP, we realized that it would be paradoxical to make a film in black and white because the book is full of colors, you know. Camus described the blue of the sea, the sun, the red dress of Marie, many color elements of color in the book. But for us, it was quite obvious to use the black and white because we wanted to play on the glare, you know, and on the sun, on the heat. And with the white of the black and white, you can, especially with the digital today, you can push the white a lot and create something very luminous. And it's important, especially for this story in which the sun is one of the lead character of the story.
Yeah. Tell me about Pierre Lotan as well. I really thought he was magnificent in this. I mean, he's one of my favorite contemporary French actors. He plays an awful man, but in a way, what I like is he has this magnetism which seems to drag the protagonist into this abyss, really. And it's this magnetism of machismo and kind of this, he's an alpha male, as we say, but it's a wonderful energy between the two.
Yes, it's the third time I worked with him. I think he's a great actor. He's difficult to direct because he has so many ideas of what he wants to make. But the idea with this character was to make a kind of tribute to the actors of the 30s in France, in the French cinema, like Jean Gabin, all this kind of characters. And it was very touching because he wanted to make a likable character with a bad person, you know, who has a bad behavior. But it gives contrast and ambiguity, which is good for the part of Santos.
Yeah, and also it explains this kind of dark charisma that he has. I mean, he's a wife beater.
Exactly.
He's a very violent man.
He's racist.
He's racist too. He's incredibly racist. And yet he is very charismatic, and I think it's a wonderful role. I mean, how did you direct Voisin, by the way? Because it's such a powerful performance.
It was a big challenge for him because he is exactly the opposite of the character. I made already a film with him some years ago called Summer of 85. And in this film, the character was very close to him. You know, Benjamin is really an actor. He's a lot of seduction. He's very warm. He's very nice. And he wants to seduce everybody. So with Meursault, it was exactly the opposite. So I asked him not to act. And it's quite complex to ask to an actor not to act. But it was a big challenge. And I asked him to watch the film of Robert Bresson, especially Pickpocket, you know, because Bresson asked to the actors to become some kind of models. and to have no psychology, to don't try to act like in theater. So it was what I asked to Benjamin. He did it, but it was he suffered a lot during the shooting. At the end of the shooting, he was totally depressed.
I could understand
because
why.
It's an easy part. It's an easy part.
Yeah. Tell me, what do you think this film says today? I don't normally. I mean, this is almost a banal question, and I don't ask it to most directors. But I think it's such a strong. The source material, this book, is so strong, and what it says is so mm-hmm. strong. And I have to ask, we're in a particular moment at the moment in the world. What do you think? What do you hope to communicate with this film today? And how do you think this film will communicate to will talk to audiences?
I think it's better for me to answer you in French for this question, especially. En fait, je crois que c'est, si
in fact, I think that if this is such a powerful book which provokes us to question our existence, how to react, how to be in relation with the world today, I believe that Camus is not suggesting nihilism. In fact, he is offering the opposite, a type of revolution or uprising against the absurdity of the world. And when we see all that is happening in the world today with the wars, the rise of the extreme right, the rise of nationalism, I think that Camus is a great answer.
And the absurdism in it, how does that work as a provocation, do you think, in your mind?
Je pense que, en fait, on a du mal à rationaliser ce qui se passe. C'est pour
I
ça
think
qu'on
that,
se face à
in
des
fact,
choses.
We are unable to rationalize what is happening. That's why we find ourselves confronted with things which we cannot fully comprehend. So, confronted with this, what are we left with? I think that the message from Camus is to fight or stand up against all the ideologies. In the film, this concerns Catholic ideology, which was very important during the 1930s in France. But this could be any ideology, fascism, communism. Therefore, the struggle or fight is a way to survive and to better understand the world.
I want to finally ask about the music in the film, which I think helps this atmosphere that is mm-hmm. hypnotic, but also evokes mm. this sense of something off, of something that's overripe and starting to decay, you know, something rotting, mm-hmm. something decadent. And it's music by Fatima Al-Qadari. Tell me about, you know, commissioning the music for this soundtrack.
I discovered Fatima with the film of Mati Diop, Atlantic. I loved the music, so I met her and I asked her if she wanted to work on the film. And first she needed to know what will be my point of view about the Arab, because she comes from Kuwait. And I realized making the film that for many Arab people, the film was a kind of hurt. You know, because they don't exist in the book. So she needed to know if I will give a voice to the Arab community. And so she read my script and she understood what I wanted to do. And she was very happy with the fact I developed the female characters. So we decided to work together, and she was great because she works with electronic and old instruments, and she creates really an atmosphere, something very melodious and at the same time very mysterious, which was very helpful for the film.
Yeah. What was your brief to her, by the way?
I don't really remember, but I think I asked her to create a kind of atmosphere in which I could have Occidental music and Arab music in the same time, you know, a mix between the two, because it's a story about two communities living in parallel. So I wanted to have these two tones in the same music.
François Ozon, thank you so much for coming on and talking to me about this film.
Thank
I really
you
loved
you.
It.
François Ozon, and you also heard from the interpreter Sally Blackwood. The Stranger is in cinemas. Going back to Edward Said, he once wrote something else about Albert Camus. In his 1993 book Culture and Imperialism, he wrote that Camus' narratives have a negative vitality in which the tragic human seriousness of the colonial effort achieves its last great clarification before ruin overtakes it. These narratives express a waste and sadness we have still not completely understood or recovered from. Those words from 1993. I think Ozon's adaptation expresses that waste and sadness. I think it also proposes an alternative reading of violence that's born out of repressed queer desire. And anyone who knows Ozon's work won't be surprised to hear that. I think, however, that's something that Ozon leaves open to interpretation. The Stranger is a very good film from one of Europe's best. You're listening to The Screen Show on ABC Radio National with me, Jason DeRosso, an hour of conversations about the big and small screen. Finally this week, one of the best documentaries from last year has hit a local streaming platform. That platform is Mubi. And the film is called My Undesirable Friends, Part 1. The second installment, we're told, is releasing sometime later this year. The director, who you're about to meet, is the Russian-American Julia Lochtev. And the film she's made plunges you into the youthful and passionate world of dissident journalism in Russia as the war on Ukraine crescendos and censorship ramps up. It is shot on iPhones, so it's an up-close and intimate perspective on what it feels like to be on the receiving end of authoritarian government censorship. It is not a position any of us would like to be in. It is nightmarish. Well, that would be one way of describing it. But it's also a film that leaves you in awe of the courage of the mostly young women who we see in the frame. Julia Lochtev, coming up. Julia Lochtev, it's a real pleasure to have you on The Screen Show. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Let's place the audience in the time frame of the beginnings of this project for you, because it is, in some ways, I think you might agree, another world, really, when we look back.
It really is a world that almost doesn't exist anymore. So I started filming 4.5 months before Russia started a full-scale war in Ukraine. Of course, at that point, nobody knew that Russia would start a full-scale war. And at the time, Russia was naming all of these journalists as foreign agents, and there was a sense that something was happening, but people didn't really understand what was happening to them. And so I ended up being basically in the right place at the right time, or possibly the wrong place at the wrong time, and ended up capturing what is really the last days of the opposition working in Russia before all of these people had to flee during the first week of the war, when it became incredibly difficult and nearly impossible to be an independent journalist in Russia or to continue to work from inside of Russia, and people fled into exile.
When you say foreign agents, I think we need to point out to people who may not realize what that label meant in practical terms for the journalists' work, in terms of the kind of disclaimer that they would have to use. Tell me about that disclaimer.
Well, let's say you, for example, were named a foreign agent, and it was people that could be like you. It was some very young journalists, not necessarily, you know, not the most famous journalists in Russia. All kinds of people were being named across the board foreign agents. So that would mean you would have to start your show with a short introduction that the show was brought to you by a source of mass media foreign agent, or Jason DeRosso, you know, functioning as a foreign agent. And not only that, but you would also have to, let's say you wanted to post a cat picture on Instagram tonight when you came home, that would also have to be marked with, this was brought to you by a foreign agent, which basically kind of undermined the credibility of everything you did. Not only that, but if you went out for, let's say, a drink tonight and, you know, bought a beer tonight, this would also have to be declared to the government. So all of the personal expenses that you had were supporting your activities as a foreign agent. So this would have to be reported to the government and could be made public.
It is just such an extraordinary situation. And you already mentioned earlier that these often, and certainly when we're talking about the journalists in your film, some of them anyway, they're quite young. They look like junior journalists. They're in their early 20s. As events start to unfold, the terrible events of what happens over these sort of weeks and months, it affects them emotionally in ways that are really affecting to watch. And you really feel their, well, that mix of emotions that they have, their fear, their frustration, their anger. What was that like for you shooting all of that raw emotion as it started to simmer to the surface?
Absolutely. I mean, they are very, very young. A lot of them are in their early 20s. And they regularly refer to Harry Potter as a way of understanding Putin's Russia. They're incredibly young. But some of them have gone through things that I can only begin to imagine. In fact, the youngest character, Ksyusha, at the time we meet her, she's 23, and her fiancé is awaiting trial for treason. He's also a journalist. He ends up being sentenced to 22 years in prison and is now in a prison in Russia. So they're also incredibly, incredibly tough. So of course I felt protective of them, but geez, they are so much tougher than I will ever be.
They're incredibly tough. And I think partly the other consequence of a lot of these journalists being so young is that they have this, what looks to me as someone much older than them, a strange capacity to also laugh in the face of disaster. And there is a levity sometimes to the way they interact. And that makes for a very compelling dynamic in your film, I think. There's a lot of light and shade. Sometimes within the one scene, there's sort of tears and laughter.
Absolutely. I always say that, you know, for a film about political repression in a cold place, it's kind of unexpectedly warm and funny. And I think there's a long history, obviously, in Russia of dealing with awful things with dark humor. And, you know, our characters are very much in that tradition. And also they're very young. And so you're constantly going back and forth between terrible things are happening, but the only way we can deal with it is by laughing at times. And of course, once Russia does start a full-scale invasion of Ukraine, that laughter stops. It becomes very striking in the film because suddenly all of these people who are just talking a mile a minute and full of laughter and joy and humor, suddenly they're absolutely shell-shocked.
Were there ever moments where you as an older person and with, I suppose, everything that your parents told you about the country, were you thinking, I feel like jumping in here and telling these young people what to do, whether that's get out now, whether that's, you know, cut your losses. I don't know. Were there ever moments like that where you had to bite your tongue?
I don't think so. But I think it's also, I also didn't believe the war was possible. Really, nobody. You talk to Ukrainians, they also say the same thing. Nobody actually, you know, Moscow bombing Kiev, invading, you know, in a way this is, you know, and I have to always kind of say this, everybody that I was filming, you know, if you ask them when the war started, it was in 2014, you know, with Crimea, with the Donbass. And, you know, it was a scale of war that in a way people had gotten used to. But it was really what happened was utterly unimaginable. And so there was no advice I could give because I was no wiser. And you're really living through that realization with these people. And I think that's kind of important. You know, when do you know is the time to leave? How do you know if it's tomorrow or was it yesterday?
Yeah, yeah.
And I didn't have any answers for that. And this is like the last, it really is the last moment when the opposition is able to function within Russia and everybody thinks, you know, maybe we can hang on another day. Maybe we can hang on another month. Maybe we can keep working here. And even once the full-scale war starts and Russia starts outlawing, even calling it a war, becomes a criminal offense and starts banning independent media and forcing them to use language only the Ministry of Defense uses. Even then, everyone was trying to say, okay, maybe if we do this, maybe we can keep working and telling the truth one more day, just one more day, until it literally came to the point where it was a conversation of, are we working tomorrow or, well, no. We're going to the airport.
Yeah. You use some footage of broadcasts put out by RAIN TV
in these very hot moments at the beginning of the war where language becomes such a contested thing, where the anchor is interviewing, I think, someone from Ukraine, but it's someone with a very, very much a dissident view of the war and is not using government-sanctioned language. And you see her really bending over backwards. I mean, there are all these sort of linguistic acrobatics to obviously be sympathetic to the point of view and give voice to the point of view of this guest on her show. But at the same time, keep reminding the audience in this Orwellian way, I suppose, of the language that should be being used.
It's an impossible position to be in, and it really works out. I mean, at that point, they were really desperate. Like, at some point, you know, it was not allowed to say war. You can't call it a war. I mean, they called it a war at first, then the, you know, the communications authority was calling them and saying, no, 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 don't use the war. We're going to take you, you know, we're going to block your website now. So they started, for example, using the word war, but then the on-screen headline would say, what's going on in Ukraine? You know, because they would, the authorities would notice the on-screen headline more. And of course, they would talk about the war, or they would say kind of these contortions like, you know, what Russia calls a special military operation, but the, what the rest of the world calls a war, an invasion, Russia's aggression. So all these ways to just try to be able to hang on one more day to continue telling the truth. And of course, that never works out. They hung on a week after a week. Even that was impossible, and everybody had to flee, and they all continue now to work in exile to report the truth on the war and report the truth on Putin's regime. But it's this negotiation that people are constantly in the middle of, just to try to, and I think that's something I'm seeing very much in the U.S. Right now. As an American, so much of the film now echoes with me, with people trying to find ways to just keep going. How do you, you know, universities are certainly facing this. How do you continue to operate? Usually it doesn't work out well.
Julia Lochtev speaking about her documentary My Undesirable Friends, Part 1, which is available to watch on Mubi. The full interview, by the way, with Julia is available for you to listen to by scrolling back to the Screen Show episode from July 3 last year. Time for me to go. Thanks to producer Sarah Corbett and to the ABC Radio National sound engineers. I'm Jason DeRosso. This has been The Screen Show, and I'll be back with another episode soon. Until then, stay golden.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.